In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So, you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. Welcome to the latest episode in our Everything You Wanted to Know series. In today's podcast, we'll be talking about the East India Company with John Wilson, who's Professor in Modern History at King's College London. John has written widely on British rule in India, and right now he's focusing on the post-colonial world. Putting the questions to John was our Deputy Digital Editor, Eleanor Evans.
Thanks so much for joining us today, John.
Thank you. It's great to join you.
Great. So as usual, we'll cover the top questions put to Google about this subject, along with some excellent listener questions that have come in over the last few weeks. And to start with, perhaps we can just establish which East India Company we're talking about here and when it was established.
We're talking about the English East India Company, which was established in 1600. In a sense, it wasn't even English. This was the London East India Company, because it was very much founded by traders from the City of London, and its trade was often opposed by merchants from other parts of England. So, later on, as the English state becomes the British state after the Act of Union 1707, and so forth, the English East India Company has more of a kind of British role, but to start with, it is very much English and very much London. And there is a Dutch East India Company, there's the Estado de Indies, which is the Portuguese company, there are French organisations, there's a Danish East India Company even that develop.
So can we talk a bit about how this English or this London company is formed then? The structure of it, the revolutionary nature of it almost, and had any charter like this been granted before?
Yes, I mean it's not revolutionary. It is a change in the structure of financing trade though. So it's kind of an incremental change. There had been companies before throughout the 1500s, the kind of Muscovy Company, for example. A variety of companies that trade with the Levant Company, trade with the Middle East. You have the companies that are interested in trading and colonizing the Americas. So the East India Company is very much within that kind of world. What's distinct about the East India Company in the moment it's founded is it's a joint stock company in which it's the company itself that does the trading rather than the individual traders. So up until that point, companies had tended to be coalitions of traders who banded together and retained their individual trading interests. But the East India Company pushes that a little bit further and actually says, if you are involved in the East India Company, if you're a merchant in the East India Company, you don't have an individual trading interest. Your interests are subordinated into the interests of the company as a whole, which is the way in which we, kind of see companies now. If you work for Google and then start, setting up your own private internet search engine, you're going to get sacked. And exactly the same thing was going on in the East India Company.
So this joint enterprise then, can we talk a bit more about where they were trading and what the products were?
Well, I mean, to start with, the East India Company was interested in trading predominantly in Southeast Asia. There was all sorts of kind of discussion of the great riches of the East Indies, of the Spice Islands and so forth. And it was initially, kind of the idea of spices that is attractive and kind of luxury food items, I guess, that is attractive to London merchants. And also the idea of a market, for kind of English goods. And at the time, it's kind of wool goods predominantly. Selling wool to kind of hot Asian countries didn't work out particularly well for obvious reasons. But then through a kind of complicated process and the way in which the English fails to compete with the Dutch, I think, is one key factor. The company moves westwards and moves to India, and so becomes much more interested in kind of sort of the Indian South Asian peninsula and trades still in spices, still is importing spices, but is also particularly became interested in cotton and in textiles and so forth. And that's what really grew the company's commercial role the company's trade expanded, particularly with the expansion of trade in cotton, at the same time as a kind of consumer revolution is happening in England and in the whole of Europe, really, where people are starting to kind of wear finer fabrics and what were once very, very sort of elite products, cotton shirts and so forth, become, sort of items that ordinary members of the middle class, not people who are poor, but sort of middle class people can wear. So those kind of two things combine.
And so these are manufactured goods that are manufactured in India rather than raw materials.
Correct. Yeah, exactly. So these are manufactured. It's manufactured clothes. There's all sorts of interesting innovations occur. So cloth sizing originates with the East India Company for England, because if you're going to buy lots of shirts, you need to know roughly what kinds of sizes you need to buy. Whereas if you're having them made in England, then your tailor will make them, and it's much more simple. You just give them the measurements. So it's manufactured goods. It is some cloth as well. So it's both of those things.
And you mentioned some spices and the goods that initially attracted them to the area. There are other companies, the Dutch and so on, that have a greater claim in these areas. Is that right?
Yeah. So in Southeast Asia, in Indonesia, Malaysia, and so forth, Dutch East India Company just kind of retains more power for longer. And these areas that initially the Portuguese were much more involved in, and then the Dutch East India Company retained some kind of dominance. And obviously Indonesia remains kind of a Portuguese, the Netherlands remains the kind of dominant European power in Indonesia until the 1940s.
Mm-hmm. Okay. If we can talk about India then, what's happening in India at this time? There's a Mughal Empire, but what's happening in India? What's the state of power there?
So in talking really about the 1600s in India, this is a kind of relatively prosperous society, and all sorts of debates about kind of the relative standard of living in the kind of most prosperous parts of India compared to the most prosperous parts of Europe, but it's not that different. The politics is complicated, and you have a sort of an empire, but the empire has quite a weak presence throughout the whole of India, and there's lots of smaller kind of states, principalities, governorships, etc., who have more dominance. And trade is very, very important, and trade is important to sustaining political power in India. Often, I mean, it's very different in different parts of India. This is a very big place. So this is somewhere that is vibrant, has really kind of strong maritime and also kind of landed trading connections that, European trading company wanting to kind of get a slice of the Indian economy, really, would be very, very interested in having some kind of presence within.
Right. And so when this British English company first starts making inroads into India, if you like, what's the kind of response? I know we're talking again, you mentioned about a vast area, but what's the more general response? Is it favourable to the trade, or is there some hesitance there?
So there's a missing piece here, which okay. Somewhere we need to talk about the East India Company, what kind of organisation the East India Company is. So the East India Company was initially founded by kind of London traders, but what's very, very important about it is the fact that it is a company at a time when most trade is not organised by companies. And that's the really, really important thing. When we see that word company, we need to kind of forget most of the things we know about companies when we're talking about the early East India Company, because what company really means is organisation. And in some ways, it means something a bit like a state. So the East India Company is more like a government than it is like a company today. It's interested in making money, but the reason why the traders who wanted to trade with India or with Indonesia or wherever created a company is because they thought that to trade in India or Southeast Asia or whatever, you needed to have weapons, you needed to have an army, you needed to have kind of a legal system, you needed to have the kind of things that we now would consider to be more the prerogative of a state than a company. And so when the East India Company went to India, it went there not as simply a kind of bunch of private traders who arrive peacefully and want to trade, in an entirely sort of consensual way, as we would normally imagine companies would do. In most cases, obviously, there are exceptions. But it went there as a violent force. And there's a lot of controversy around that at the time and throughout the kind of 17th century where critics of the East India Company say, actually, we can trade with India perfectly peacefully. If we go to India as merchants, as some did, arrive and talk to the kind of governors of provinces, talk to local merchants, we can do business and it works and we make money and it's mutually beneficial. And so when traders arrived in India as traders, they were received often very positively. They were received, as people who were able to ship goods that were being produced in India to markets in Europe that otherwise Indian traders wouldn't have access to. They were treated as people who potentially have had supplies of capital. They were often involved in kind of sort of inter-Indian trade or trade with other parts of Asia, for example, kind of the horse trade to Persia, to Iran. So as traders, the East India Company were received very positively, and other traders who were flouting the monopoly. The East India Company establishes a monopoly and says that only the company is able to trade with India, but there are traders, British traders, who flout that. So as traders, the English merchants, British merchants are treated well, but the East India Company is always doing more than trading. It's always saying, in order to trade, we need to use force, we need to threaten, we need to kind of build forts. In order to kind of back up trade. And to that kind of presence, not surprisingly, the Indian response is fairly negative.
Perhaps we could talk more about that move towards force over collaboration in a little while. But just talking about in the 1600s, how the East India Company was perceived by the royals, by the government. I mean, clearly they were sanctioned to do this kind of trading at this point. There was little problem with them doing this.
So the East India Company was, in Britain, the East India Company was an organisation which had royal sanction. It was approved entirely by, a royal charter, which later becomes a kind of parliamentary charter. This is a body that that is in a sense an arm of the state, or at least has a very, very strong state stamp saying that what it's doing is right. Its structures as a company, it's owned by its investors, very prominent kind of people, members of the royal family, monarchs kind of invest in it. Early in its history, it also actually financially kind of backs the British state. So it backs British governments, it lends money to the state. By the 1760s, 1770s, the relationship is the other way around, and the East India Company is needing to borrow money from the British government. But to start with, it's a financial support for the British state. So it exists alongside a set of other institutions that exist that are created in around the turn of the 17th century, such as the Bank of England, that are very much part of this mercantile financial state that's created in England. The East India Company is always is always two different things at the same time. It's always a trader which is trading, if you like, consensually to some degree, and also is also using force and extracting, kind of trying to extract concessions from government, you know, and trying to insist on monopolies and so forth. And that's kind of there from the start. And what the factor that's blocking, if you like, the East India Company's you know, kind of expansion and its kind of increasing use of violence to kind of to trade and to make money is simply the fact that it's just not very powerful compared to the Indian states. That the Mughal state is very powerful. You have an empire that is capable of deploying, you know, millions of troops, et cetera, et cetera. And so, you know, if the East India Company, you know, gets a bit uppity, you know, kind of thinks that it needs to kind of put men in arms into battle in order to kind of get its, you know, insist upon its commercial privileges or whatever, it's going to be defeated. And that's what happens until the kind of until well into the 18th century. Mm-hmm. So I think there's always the kind of potential for violence, and fortification is certainly from the, you know, kind of from the end of the 1600s, certainly a century before any kind of conquest, there were forts are being built.
Right. So is it fair to say then there is a obviously you say violence is always prevalent, but there's a shift in violence for protection of trade interests and all the rest of it, but then a move to an imperial project and violence for those means.
But I mean, so violence is always used to protect the company's presence. And I don't think, in a sense, there is never, the imperial project comes incredibly late. But what there is a desire by the British to protect what they have, and to protect what they have often in a very kind of sort of paranoid way. So they don't trust Indian rulers, they don't trust Indian traders necessarily. So they'll kind of fortify, and then that creates a kind of dynamic that means that they needed to kind of bring more troops in order to defend what they have already. So, and that's how kind of their borders, if you like, keep pushing outwards and outwards, and they keep on conquering more territory. And there is the opportunity for money. Increasingly through the 18th century, not only from trade, but also from effectively hiring out their troops to Indian rulers, you know, kind of being sort of effectively mercenaries, you know, kind of because they're building this military force in order to protect their presence because they believe force is necessary. They have troops that can be hired out then for use by Indian rulers. And that's kind of how the company begins to get more and more involved in sort of in war and so forth in India. The imperial project is something that comes actually very, very late.
Okay, well, perhaps I jumped us forward a bit there then. But talking about this growth of force, there's a question on Twitter from at Peter Murphy 1 asking purely how did they recruit soldiers competing with the regular British Army? Was it just a matter of money, or how did that recruitment happen?
So they recruited soldiers from Britain, you know, competing with the British Army. They recruited from different places, you know, kind of tending to, you know, lots of kind of Irish troops, for example. You know, the kind of possibility of kind of potentially greater, you know, greater spoils, etc., kind of from going to India was there. They were recruiting at times when maybe the kind of regular British Army wasn't fighting in Europe, so there wasn't kind of so much of a need for troops. So they're kind of part of, if you like, the sort of British European military labour market. But it's important that, you know, kind of throughout the growth of the East India Company, the majority of troops are recruited in India. Most troops who fight in India for the East India Company, at least from the kind of middle of the 18th century, as the company's army increases, are Indian. And there, the East India Company is part of a military labour market. I mean, there are people whose family business is being a soldier, and that's what they do. And they, you know, kind of find an army to work for. And the East India Company increasingly is the most lucrative and most secure kind of place to work in that kind of situation.
Okay, so how else do they go about consolidating this power? Then obviously they're gaining the manpower, but there's also the decline in the Mughal Empire. How much of that is a factor, or how else do they go about consolidating that growth?
So I think that what's important in the rise of the East India Company is a moment of crisis in Indian governance. You know, 30 years ago, everyone would have talked about the decline of the Mughal Empire. You'd have talked about the crisis of the Mughal Empire, and that created some kind of power vacuum. That's not true. I mean, that's not what happened. There's always effective states in India. If India had been anarchy, then the East India Company wouldn't have been interested because probably there wouldn't have been money to be made. What did escalate and expand, allow the company to expand were moments of very particular crisis when maybe for 5 years, maybe 10 years, whatever, there's a kind of a breakdown of ordinary politics and, you know, a new kind of political order is coming about. And there you have lots of Indian rulers who need armies and are willing to pay the East India Company to support them. Succession battles and just sort of, you know, kind of uncertainty. And so one very particularly important moment, which I think is the most important moment in the rise of the East India Company, is 1739 and the arrival of the kind of Iranian ruler, Nader Shah, in India, who arrives with this army in a kind of what seems quite a shock. He defeated the Mughal Emperor in Delhi, and really kind of the whole Indian political system goes into shock because all of a sudden the figurehead has been effectively decapitated, and Nader Shah very briefly declares himself to be the Mughal Emperor and says that the Mughal Emperor of the time is his viceroy, and, you know, kind of takes lots of money out of the Mughal treasury and kind of eventually goes back to Iran with it. And that sort of creates this sort of shock that lasts for a few years. And that means actually that the kind of amount of violence and the amount of instability across India increases. And that means that the East India Company has an opportunity really to you know, hire out its military wares. And you know, it has these forts, and it has forts that are quite secure and places where people with money or, you know, family and so forth could have some kind of relative amount of safety. And so in very uncertain, unstable political times. And so you have, you know, Fort William, Calcutta, for example, being used as a kind of as a safe haven by different kind of Indian families and so forth. And that then kind of embroils the company into Indian politics and helps this process of expansion. So it's not so much the Mughal Empire's decline as very particular moments of crisis that give the company an opportunity to kind of expand its political role.
Right. So, yeah, clearly many, many moments of opportunity there. But how did it move towards this, if this is the right word, exploitation on a greater scale? I mean, many will know, perhaps going a bit later on in the timeline, the rape of Bengal and exploitation of these regions on a much greater scale. What's that transition?
It's wrong to talk about the company's exploitation on a greater scale because the East India Company never extracted extraordinary amounts of resources from anywhere in India and then transported it into Britain. You know, lots of people would say that. I don't think that's what occurred. What is more important in kind of meaning that kind of East India Company ruled India is relatively poor is actually the breakdown of political institutions. Because the company isn't interested in the wealth of India, it's not interested in economic growth, it's interested in making sure that its staff are paid, and it's interested in making sure that its presence is safe. And it doesn't matter if, you know, 20 miles away, you know, peasants are extremely poor, or if peasants are wealthy. I mean, there's a kind of, you know, the famine of Bengal in 1769-70 was not caused by the company going and taking large quantities of grain from every Indian peasant, although it was going around doing that to some degree. It's caused by the complete breakdown of the market and of trade in the province. So that traders just don't trust that they're ever going to get any money if they sell anything. So they keep their grain in their grain warehouses, people starve. I think that's the most important way to see the kind of the negative features of the company's presence. It's this quite violent presence that is really only interested in protecting its own security. And of course, there are people who do make money in that situation. There are people who make lots of money. There's plunder, yeah, of course, you know, of course. But more importantly, and more generally, over a longer period of time, what happens is the kind of breakdown of effective governance throughout British ruled India. I mean, the company is exactly the opposite of what people described it as later, you know, as somehow some effective rule of law, Pax Britannica. You know, in fact, I think probably there's more violence in East India Company ruled India than there was beforehand, because, you know, kind of local landlords, there's not much of a check on local landlords going up, beating up peasants, for example, that kind of thing. So violence and oppression gets pushed downwards. It's very, you know, the East India Company is not really interested in murder. They're not really interested in theft. They're interested in crimes against the company, you know, kind of. So there's the state is not effective in the way in which we'd imagine it needs to be in order to kind of make society kind of prosperous.
Mm-hmm. So if we can go again, sorry, jumping around again, back to the earlier days, a question from a teacher who teaches A-level, Alex Dobbs on Twitter. In what ways did the growth of the East India Company in the 17th century bring about the change in the English economy? And considering the historical context, how significant were these changes?
So it's hard to say that the East India Company directly caused changes in the English economy, but there is a kind of symbiotic relationship between things the East India Company is doing and changes in the English economy. And in particular, the rise of a sort of consumer culture, the way in which goods that were considered luxury goods became affordable for a larger section of the population, so kind of middle class, not just kind of a small elite. And I think the kind of an expansion overall in the amount of kind of international trade that the British economy is kind of plugged into. So, you know, kind of things like, which I mentioned a moment ago, you know, clothing sizes are introduced. So the way in which kind of trade happens changes. So it's, you know, bulk goods are being bought and shipped back rather than, you know, bulk manufactured goods are being bought and shipped back rather than, you know, kind of manufacturing happening kind of very locally to where people are. So those kind of shifts are important. But I wouldn't say it's the East India Company necessarily that's driving that. It's kind of, it's surfing shifts that are happening and probably would have, that other organisations would have facilitated, I think, you know, kind of, yeah. I mean, maybe another company, maybe if the East India Company hadn't have been there, the Dutch company would have been meeting this demand, you know. But, you know, it's hard to imagine that the English would have allowed that to happen. So an East India Company would have been created, which is kind of precisely what does happen. So, but there is a really important change. There's a kind of change towards this kind of pattern of consumer spending that's important.
If we look at if there is such a thing, an average administrator in the East India Company, the experience or the influence they held, how did that change from the smaller forts that were initially established through to you know, later positions of influence and positions of power?
So the average administrator working for the East India Company in the, say, the early 17th century would be a kind of clerk, would be someone who, you know, maybe would be, you know, working within a fort or within a factory, most likely to be involved in trade in some way to begin with. But, you know, would potentially be involved, you know, keeping warehouses, might be involved in something relating to kind of maintaining military power, maintaining the kind of the fortifications and so forth. You know, they may be involved in negotiating with local rulers, etc. But, you know, kind of trade would have been taken up a lot of their time. They would have, you know, seen themselves really as kind of citizens of that, the community of that fort. They would have, you know, kind of all of the, you know, kind of English people there would have eaten together every day, etc., etc. There's a kind of a kind of life, kind of collegial life, if you like, within the fort, you know, to begin with, and so forth. And that obviously shifts enormously. You know, the average administrator by the 1830s, 1840s would have been stationed in a district capital somewhere. Would be you know, stationed in a town where they're perhaps one of two, three, four, maybe five to, depends really. You know, five other kind of Britons. There would have been maybe a kind of surgeon. You know, some kind of military presence, or maybe a judge. They might have been a tax collector, a collector, etc. So a relatively small community of Britons within an Indian town. That's the difference. And they're you know, they would have some kind of fortified place they could live. But, you know, kind of they and most likely actually they live on the edge of Indian towns. So you know, you look at kind of Indian cities now, and the area, the kind of the area of government headquarters are sort of on the edge of the old pre-British kind of a commercial centre often. But that's a very different life. It's a life about government. It's a life about, you know, maybe kind of presiding over a court. It's a life around, a lot of it would have been about making sure that Indian landholders pay their taxes and figure out what to do if they don't. Do you call the troops in? Do you sell their assets? I think an important thing is that the amount of rules, if you like, that they're subject to have increased enormously in that, say by the 1820s or whatever, there's a system of regulations that govern British power. And if you like, the aim of those regulations is to provide security for British officials because they're in a country they don't understand. They can barely speak the language. They're supposed to speak the language, but usually they don't very well. They don't know what to do in most situations. And so they need some kind of guide, and the regulations are there in order to some degree to hold them to account, but to provide a sense of what do they need to do. So effectively they've become bureaucrats from, clerks and merchants, kind of who lead some kind of bureaucratic life in a fort. The British official has become simply a kind of a bureaucrat whose role is to kind of uphold the kind of bureaucratic nature of British power in India.
Okay. So you mentioned there's obviously a huge amount of money at stake and there's a huge amount driving the self-interest of the company to protect itself. But I think, is it fair to say that in popular view, certainly corruption and embezzlement seem pretty endemic? They're popularly perceived to be endemic. How true is that?
The corruption and embezzlement was endemic in the company's kind of rule. But I think that's missing the point. I think that kind of, if you like, corruption is corruption from a company that is acting in a way that is not kind of benefiting India particularly. So, and I think there's a lot of, what's really interesting is that the East India Company itself is critical of corruption. The British state is interested in corruption and embezzlement. When we talk about, corruption and embezzlement, kind of is endemic in kind of the late 18th or early 19th century, we're actually using the kind of language that the company is using. That's exactly the kind of thing that the company is concerned with. And so periodically, the East India Company or the British state says, oh, look, it's all this one person's fault. The Bengal famine or, this poverty or whatever, you can blame this one person because they've just been taking lots of money. But maybe actually it's kind of something more systematic about the nature of British power as it develops in the area. So corruption's more important, if you like, as almost as a kind of language, as a way in which the British are talking about India all the time, constantly saying the problem is corruption, whereas in a sense that's avoiding the kind of bigger issue, which is, well, what's the nature of British power in the subcontinent.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Taking us back in the timeline, probably to the early days of when we're talking about, a top Google question is about the East India Company and the slave trade. And obviously, there must be some key links there. I'd really like to cover them in this chat. What can you say about those links?
So there is some kind of connection with the East India Company and the slave trade, but it's not huge. So the East India Company is involved in the slave trade in East Africa, in the Indian Ocean, to some degree. And various moments, I think, employs slaves, etc. But it's not a kind of major engine of the slave trade. And by the early 19th century, at the time when you have kind of slavery coming under a lot of criticism and big campaigns against the slave trade, a lot of people point to the East India Company as something that the British should be doing instead of the slave trade. Particularly you have this whole discussion around sugar and the idea that, well, in India you can grow sugar with free labor without slaves. And so there's this argument that you can sort of shift sugar production to India. Now, what the East India Company is doing is not particularly nice. It's ruling in a dominating way. It doesn't allow it doesn't allow the population it's ruling any say in how they're being governed. But it's not slavery in the kind of formal sense. So it's involved to some degree, but later on it sort of almost becomes this opposite alternative kind of way of thinking about empire, you know, sort of as opposed to the slave trade, which you know, I think we would equally oppose now, you know, kind of, yeah, I mean, it's hard to kind of relatively say which is worse, I guess.
So in these early days then, right after the company is making forays into India, into these smaller settlements, you know, what's can you give us a sense of the scale of the profit it was making, or was it at this point, and how it grew in terms of the money it was making?
Yeah. So the company, I mean, the company's profit increases through the kind of sale of textiles, but it's a very profitable investment. I mean, it's the money is made by people investing, you know, in stocks, in stocks that have a kind of annual dividend and so forth. It's not making the kind of ordinary investors, you know, hugely abnormal returns. The way in which people have abnormal returns is through embezzlement, corruption, you know, et cetera, later on. It's, you know, when Robert Clive comes back and, you know, is given, supposedly given money by Indian rulers and that kind of thing. That's where people become hugely wealthy as a result of the company's, as a result of their role in the company. And that's kind of, I guess, illegal in the kind of company's kind of context. That would be defined as corruption. But in terms of its role as a place to invest, it was pretty profitable, but it was seen as quite a safe investment. So it's not, you know, you could make more money, you know, if you were an investor in early 18th century England than investing in the company. It would be a relatively safe investment within a kind of broader portfolio of investments. You know, kind of because by that point it established itself, and you know, et cetera, et cetera. But as I say, a very small number of people are made a lot of money through their kind of leverage, if you like, of the company institution for private gain of various kinds, which is something that the company frowns upon, occasionally allows to happen, but also occasionally, much of the time, just simply bans and tries not to happen. It's important though that then the company actually. By the time it is expanded politically, by the time the company was taking over more and more land and, you know, its army was growing. So we're talking about the 1750s, 1760s.
Yeah.
The company is not making much money occasionally, you know, and it ends up in this kind of spiral where it's sort of like the company invested more money and the British state invested more money in order to get more of a return. But then that investment then creates even more liabilities. And so its debt actually increases. You know, and you had to have these occasional moments where the company claims that it's about to make huge amounts of money, such as in 1765 when it's given the Diwani to Bengal, you know, and the company becomes the ruler, but really the kind of tax collector of Bengal, and everyone thinks this is going to mean that the East India Company all of a sudden is going to become incredibly wealthy and is going to just pay for the entirety of the British state. And you know, kind of Robert Clive is going around, you know, kind of with propaganda about how this is an amazing moment, et cetera, et cetera. But in fact, that leads to, again, more expenditure, you know, because running a government costs money. The size of the army needs to increase. The sort of paranoia that always accompanies the British presence in India means borders need to be extended even further and further.
So you just mentioned Robert Clive there, and many people might know, associate Clive of India with East India Company with this episode. Can we perhaps talk a little bit about him and maybe some of the other key players as well?
Yeah, so Robert Clive is probably the most famous figure involved in the kind of conquest of India. And he was someone who, you know, all sorts of kind of mythology about him as being a sort of rebellious, quite violent young man who, you know, sort of... was constantly getting into scrapes and all that kind of stuff, and you know, can I guess leave that to sort of the biographies and so forth. I think a couple of important points about Clive. He was someone who very much straddled kind of civilian and military life. So he kind of was employed by the East India Company as not as a soldier, but then ended up becoming a soldier. So demonstrates, I think, the fact that it was easy to shift between these different roles and kind of that. You know, trade and kind of military action were very closely connected. Secondly, his career was really all about, you know, ways in which the East India Company was used as effectively a mercenary force for Indian rulers in that period after 1739, after Nader Shah kind of, you know, you know, arrived from Iran and kind of sort of led to kind of a brief period of chaos throughout India. So the moment that made him famous was the siege of Arcot, when you know, kind of he was defending a town in kind of South India, you know, kind of for a long period of time. But what he was doing was actually kind of acting as the agent of an Indian ruler, as kind of and he was very much, you know, somebody who through the promise of money from an Indian Indian kind of ruler was you know, taking one side rather than another, you know, kind of in the kind of battles that were kind of raging throughout South India at that point in time. So to some degree the same happened at the Battle of Plassey, the most famous kind of moment when you know, kind of Clive and his forces retake Calcutta after it had been after the British presence had been driven out by the ruler of Bengal, Siraj ad Daulah, and then Clive sort of went on with his troops to defeat Siraj ad Daulah at Plassey. But he was acting there, you know, as an ally of a group of Indian merchants and administrators who wanted to get rid of Siraj ad Daulah. So again, it was a question of the British taking sides in kind of Indian battles, and that's Clive's career really sort of illustrates this really important point. I think that you know, the East India Company didn't arrive in India wanting to sort of dominate, but they got embroiled in things and got pulled into things and saw opportunities to make money and to kind of assert power and to do things that were seen as glorious. I think that Clive is constantly driven by, you know, an idea of what the headlines in Britain are going to be saying about him. And if he thinks that if he can go back as the great conqueror who led British troops in this battle or that battle, he's going to be famous and rich. You know, but it's very much as, you know, kind of as participants within kind of Indian politics that drives that kind of process.
And what's Clive's... how do we perceive Clive today? What's the kind of the reading of him?
I think Clive was incredibly greedy, no question. You know, he used every opportunity he could to enrich himself personally. I think as somebody who was very keen on his own image, someone who was very keen on displaying the valour of somebody who, you know, kind of fights and conquers well. I think we need to kind of realise that the 18th century world that Clive was part of was very, very different from ours, in that war is often seen as a good thing just for its own sake. Conquest is something that was positive just for because it demonstrated the values that many people wanted to emulate. You know, lots of philosophers at the time, you know, complain that kind of the public likes a good conqueror, likes a good hero, and maybe in some ways not so different from some things now. But and so, you know, that's what's driving Clive, is that, you know, kind of desire for money, certainly. But, you know, kind of more importantly than that, I think, is the sense in which he, you know, kind of he wants to make a name for himself and wants to be a hero within this sort of very 18th century idea of heroism. But I think that's all very much part of a kind of a political scene, which is about Indian politics rather than about sort of, you know, British politics necessarily.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
Until it, you know, really takes the kind of the introduction of troops from Britain and, you know, soldiers from Britain and other parts of the empire to reconquer. And it is very much reconquer, very violently reconquer, you know, kind of North India.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Canva presents stories to keep you up at night. It was an ordinary work day until...
The Singapore presentation is at 3 a.m.
The office was shocked.
That's when we sleep.
Maya made it less scary with Canva.
I'll just record my presentation so Singapore can watch it anytime.
Record and present anytime with Canva Presentations at canva.com. Designed for work.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
Okay, so these opportunities, these interests of both trade of conquest, they all coalesce. And at its peak of influence of territory, how much are we talking here? What kind of influence did the East India Company hold in India?
The East India Company is at its peak in terms of power at the moment of its fall. And I don't know if you want me to go this quickly to this late, but the East India Company is at its most powerful at the moment before it is abolished. In 1857, by 1857, the East India Company had simply become the British government of India. It no longer really had any kind of commercial role, but it was kept as the organisation that ruled India on behalf of the British state, and ruled over two thirds of India, and at least formally, and of course, lots of parts of that territory, were kind of governed by Indian. Indian landlords or whatever, in effect, but it's the sovereign effectively of two thirds of Indian territory, in 1857 there's a kind of rebellion from Indian troops within the kind of East India Company's army that then becomes this broader kind of peasant revolt all across North India, and the East India Company is able, with help from the British state and with help from the British army, to kind of defeat that rebellion. It's a kind of close run thing, of course, and the violence on both sides is extraordinary, is just unprecedented. But the East India Company in 1857, 1858 is able to violently assert its power, its domination over the whole of India, and that moment is really important then for setting up British rule in India for the remaining 90 years. It makes Indians who want to kind of rebel and resist think twice about really trying to deploy arms in that kind of full frontal way, because the lesson of 1857, if you like, is that kind of the British can beat you. But of course, immediately after that, the East India Company is abolished, and it was abolished because it's seen as having been responsible for this uprising. Even in the 1830s and 1840s, the East India Company has its opponents. Lots of people think that. Some people think the British shouldn't be ruling in India at all. Some people in Britain. Lots of people think that it should be the British state which is directly responsible, and that British Parliament should be directly accountable for Britain's rule in India. And those people kind of win the argument really kind of after the defeat of, after this sort of crisis and then return in 1857 and 1858, and the East India Company is abolished.
So before this rebellion, what other kind of, were there any other attempts to regulate? What kind of activities were happening there?
To regulate
the East India Company.
So from the days of Robert Clive onwards, from the 1750s, 1760s, there's a constant effort to regulate the East India Company, constant effort to eradicate corruption, which means effectively have the company as a more focused source of power in India, rather than having kind of British private interests undermine its authority. There's various moments to bring it under kind of some kind of parliamentary, supervision. And every 20 years, the East India Company's charter is renewed, and there's always a big argument in Parliament about what the terms of that renewal should be. So in 1813, there's a big debate over whether or not East India Company should allow Christian missionaries to go to India, and the argument is by the missionaries is one, and they then do start to kind of go and proselytize. In 1833, there's an argument about whether or not the company should have any kind of commercial role, and eventually it doesn't as a consequence of that, and then also what kind of force it should be and how it should be structured and so forth. So there's a constant discussion and constant debate going on, not constant so much, but periodic. Every few years there's some kind of crisis, and that calls you know, people in Parliament, British politicians, the British public kind of get involved in thinking about the East India Company. And every possible view is there. Some people think the company should be abolished and Britain should just leave India. You know, there's talk about involving Indians in the government of India, you know, kind of in the 1820s and 1830s. You know, talk even about having, you know, MPs from India in Parliament at some moments. You know, kind of that would have obviously really undermined the power of the company and of the company's interest. And what's interesting all the way through is the way the East India Company is able, through its connection to political power, in particular through the kind of 1820s and 1830s, its connection to the kind of Tory party, it's able to retain, to win the argument, I suppose, and to actually kind of persuade enough people that changing the structure of government and getting rid of the East India Company would undermine British power in India, and also would undermine the kind of financial interests of people who have some kind of stake in the company's authority. So by the 1820s and 1830s, there are just too many people who are part of, if you like, the British establishment, who have a stake in the company's survival to mean that it can be abolished until that moment of cataclysmic crisis in 1857.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned this is precipitated by that rebellion. If we could talk more generally, and I realise, again, we're talking about a vast territory and vast regional differences, but more generally about what's known about the feelings of Indian people towards the East India Company.
I mean, the company, Indians have lots of different views about the East India Company. I mean, it's very hard to say that there's a kind of single view. Obviously, there are no opinion polls or anything like that. The company is always seen as strange. So it's always seen as, by most people in India, by most kind of people who commentate and who write about it, as an organisation that is sort of out of kilter with Indian political traditions. And one of the important things about the way it acts is the fact that decisions are made behind closed doors and its power isn't visible. And, you know, in kind of Mughal and another Indian kind of political traditions, you know, kind of political power obviously is concentrated in the emperor, in the governor, in Rajas and whoever. But it's always visible. It's always, you know, there's kind of a certain splendor around it. You know, every day rulers will appear before windows, will display themselves kind of to the public in order to kind of provide some kind of security, if you like, in order to say, I'm still here, I'm still acting, you know, and there's an idea of acting somehow or other in some kind of public interest. You know, kind of obviously these are highly authoritarian societies in a certain way, but, you know, there's a kind of an idea of being accountable. And there is the idea that if you're kind of a subject of a ruler, then you can go and, you know, prostrate yourself before the ruler and they will take you seriously. And often that does happen. You know, of course, that's a myth to some degree. It's a kind of, but it does happen. There are cases where, you know, lots of cases where people do go before an Indian ruler and have some kind of justice meted out. And the company, of course, has structures of justice. It has ways in which it listens to people who have complaints. It has courts, it has a legal system. But the way in which it administers all that is very different from Indian political traditions, in that it happens behind closed doors. So there's a sense of kind of secrecy and you know, you can never quite trust the East India Company, you know, kind of there. And there's also an idea that they're always divided amongst each other. There's always these arguments between different parts of the company, because this is government often by committee. It's government where there isn't necessarily a single point of power, even when you have viceroys, you know, not viceroys, when you have governors general, power is fragmented somehow or other, you know, sort of. And so Indians notice that and think that this is kind of a very fractious, very argumentative, very very fickle kind of power that they simply can't trust. So that view is there. But obviously lots of people do work for the East India Company. There are ways in which it's possible for people to go about their ordinary business, to be good bureaucrats, to be administrators, to be soldiers. Those kind of jobs are there, and lots of them don't change that much in what you're supposed to do. You know, the company needs people to make its machinery work. So there are, you know, you can work for it, and there are people who have positive stories about East India Company rule.
Mm-hmm. Okay, interesting. We've got a couple of reader questions. We've talked obviously a lot about their involvement in India, but we've got a couple of reader questions about the Opium Wars and China. One from Vintage Victory One: was it the East India Company which brought tea to India from China? What extent was tea important to its status and power? And another reader, A. Mariam, is asking, what role did the East India Company play in the 19th century Opium War? So perhaps we could talk a bit about that triangular trade, India, between India, China and Britain, and how that kind of came about.
Yeah, so the East India Company is very, it's very instrumental in the kind of, in tea and kind of in and in obviously expanding the growth of tea, throughout the area. So, tea became by the sort of early 19th century or by the sort of 1810s, 1820s, tea is the most important trade that the East India Company is trading. I mean, everything else disappears apart from tea. Tea became a kind of an exception to, things such as, when the company sort of relinquishes its monopoly, tea is the sort of last kind of monopoly that's there. So it's important. And it's important because it's an important source of revenue, in order to sustain the commercial flows, the kind of flows of money that go between, Britain and India. And that's kind of essential there all the way through. It has a role within the Opium Wars too. It's trying to kind of maintain a monopoly on the trade of opium. It's looking for places for people to buy opium. It's kind of instrumental in that kind of context. We shouldn't overestimate the importance of tea or opium within the company's role. The company is important within the opium trade and within the tea trade, but the opium trade and the tea trade are not central to what the company is doing in India, because by the time they're important, the company is effectively acting as a state and is collecting most of its revenues coming from taxes. And, its interest is in land really more than opium or tea.
Okay. So when do we see, or do we see this shift then move from a more of a trading interest into this idea of a, might not be the right term, but a civilizing mission, or at least on the surface, they put this seeming interest out.
There never is a civilizing mission. The civilizing mission doesn't exist. The company's purpose is to maintain its own power and to maintain British prestige and so forth. And there are moments when in front of Parliament, British officials or supporters of the East India Company say, "Oh no, what we're doing is actually good for India." But it never has that as a purpose, and it never spends any money on it. I mean, you can look at that by just looking at the astonishingly tiny amount of money that the East India Company, and even after 1858, after the company's abolished, the British state spends on education and schools. It's an absolutely minuscule amount of money. So we can get really easily sidetracked by the idea of a civilizing mission when, it basically doesn't exist. When the company are building infrastructure, when the company are, even when they're opening schools, what they're doing is building machinery that allows them to survive in India, to govern in India. The schools that they open are there to train administrators to administer British institutions in order to maintain British power.
Like those taxes you mentioned.
Yeah, precisely. Like the taxes are kind of, taxes are being fed back into this kind of, it's this kind of circular process. There's this kind of circular process in which the function of the British being in India is to be in India. And all sorts of people have an interest in that, and they need to maintain their interest. And that then means that, you get things like, in the late years of the East India Company, you get things like the company starting to be interested in irrigation schemes. Well, in the 1840s and so forth. The reason why is because there's a famine, and that famine really badly affects company revenue. And so people need to go, and if there's something very peculiar about the way in which people think about the East India Company and the British in India, to think the function of the state is to civilize a country. I don't think people would normally look at the government of Britain or whatever. And, when we looked at the government of Britain, we'd think, oh, well, what is it interested in? It's interested in, it's a machine that's interested in export, in a whole a structure that has a whole series of purposes. It's not, including, of course, the welfare of the population, but that's not the way in which we normally tend to think about states in the 18th and 19th century. So why
do you think we've come to think about the ESE as...
Because we have this weird moralistic, whenever anyone uses the word empire, it becomes a moral debate. Nobody thinks about the Prussian state in the 18th century and says, did it have a civilizing mission? You know, the Prussian state in the 18th century is a state that's interesting in maintaining its power in a kind of in a geopolitical global kind of context. You know, similarly for the British state in Britain. But there's a kind of weird way in which I think probably towards the end of empire, there was as Britain was leaving empire in the 1950s and 1940s and 1950s, you know, kind of, and then subsequently, there's been a kind of an attempt to, you know, to sort of legitimize kind of, you know, something that everyone thought at the time was operating according to principles which are very different from those that kind of were floating around in government and so forth at the time. And, you know, so there's this kind of narrative that kind of moralizes things. And it's just very, very... And now we obviously have these really kind of silly arguments between, you know, kind of, you know, which relates the statues and all that kind of stuff. And people are saying, oh, no, these people were forces for good. And it's like, well, that's not how we view any other kind of government. I mean, it's the way empire became a kind of political football, I think, in the 20th century. That's what this is about. You know, I mean, we need to remember that, you know, in the 19th century, the empire, conquest was celebrated. It was seen as just a good thing in itself. You know, just being a conquering power, often you didn't need a reason for that. You know, it's about British power, and British power is a good thing.
Well, but to step perhaps on that very, very interesting point, I mean, James's question is perhaps a little binary given what you just said. Did they do any good in the world or was it all bad? And I realise it can't just be categorised simply like you just said, but I guess they're positive. He's asking more about generally about positive influence versus
I just want to not answer that question about positive or negative, because it's not the kind of question that we ask about any other kind of government. It's just a very peculiar thing that we ask of the British Empire, because empire has become this kind of political, weird political football that has no relationship actually to the real history of empire. You know, nobody in the 19th century was going around, this kind of debate about whether empire was a force for good didn't exist in the 19th century. There were certainly debates about particular moments that were seen as bad or good, but it's not, you know, there isn't the same kind of, I mean, the idea of empire as this kind of single thing doesn't make much sense, you know, kind of for a start. And even the British Empire in India. So I think that we need to accept that the way we think about politics in the 20th century is very, very different from the way in which people thought about politics in the 19th century. And you know, all the criticisms that exist of empire in the 20th century were possible in the 19th century, of course. But the kind of logic that underpinned political power and the way in which we talk about what states are for and what states do is just completely different. This is a world in which democracy is unthinkable. You know, kind of, you know, the world in which the British Empire existed. For example, you know, kind of, this is a world in which, you know, kind of, you know, most people in Britain didn't have a kind of serious say in how government is run, etc. So just things that are just so fundamentally different from what we're thinking about now make kind of empire make sense, and make that kind of question, was empire force for good, you know, kind of according to kind of our current ways of thinking, just not actually make much sense. It's just impossible to answer that kind of question.
Yeah, very, very fair, very fair point. Going back to the peak then, you mentioned that the peak of their influence, their territory, is obviously right before their fall. But putting that in some kind of context for our listeners, how much territory was under EIC control? And can you give any kind of correlation of what that would, you know, wealth-wise, what that might mean in influence today?
Well, the East India Company was the dominant political force in the whole of the Indian subcontinent, which means from Afghanistan to Burma. And, you know, it had direct kind of sovereignty or some kind of direct kind of rule over two-thirds of that, although I think it's important to then kind of sort of pick away at that a little bit and see that actually the reality of that often is that British power is quite weak in many places, and you have, you know, because as I've said, the British are interested in maintaining their power in their kind of centres of sovereignty, in, you know, kind of in their forts, in their towns, etc. They're interested in ensuring that their population is, that the British people are safe, and then they're not hugely interested in kind of what's going on elsewhere unless it affects them. So the important point is that kind of, in theory, British power is extraordinary. It's one of the largest empires in the world. But actually, the reality of British power is quite patchy. So there are areas where there isn't that much British power in practice. I mean, what's important for for Britain is that kind of 19th century, you know, sort of, you know, India is seen as important for Britain's 19th century global presence. You know, kind of, there's a reason why, you know, even in the very early 19th century, Napoleon wants to invade and you know, India, you know, kind of his occupation of Egypt is, you know, he says is all about kind of moving on then to India. So, you know, kind of Russia is trying to encroach upon the British territory in India. So in a kind of geopolitical sense, India is very, very important to Britain's kind of global presence. I think it's really hard, though, to quantify what actually that power means in India, because power, political power in the 19th century is a very different kind of thing from how we talk about political power now. You know, there's, you know, perfectly possible, I'm sure, for someone to travel for 50 miles without ever seeing someone British, you know, whatever, in India. You know, kind of the state's presence in large parts of India was fairly light. You know, kind of the British state is engaging with the East India Company state is engaging with more, you know, with elites rather than with the population at large, and so on. So, yeah, and very different from the way in which we think about government now.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we've already talked a bit about the downfall, the rebellion that prompted the British state to intervene and what happened there with the handover, but perhaps it's worth going back to that. How exactly did that transition of power happen, and what happened to the assets and to what happened there?
So, I mean, the rebellion of 1857 is if you like, the culmination of a series of revolts and wars and conflicts, you know, conflicts. And we have often had this rather false view that, you know, early in the 19th century, the British rule in India is consolidated, because if you look at a map, it looks like the East India Company is ruling most of India by the early 1820s, say. In reality, this is a period of constant struggle, conflict, war. The major political rivals to the East India Company are defeated in the 1820s, and then, you know, at least within India, and then you have, you know, kind of Punjab, you know, kind of Burma, states on the fringes that kind of are defeated kind of later on. But that process of war kind of is creating tensions within Indian society. And, you know, so British rule became in many ways more aggressive, at the same time as it relies more upon Indians to be upheld, because, you know, conflict has been fought with British, with Indian troops. So there's this kind of, this tension that's emerging really, and the rebellions increase, mutinies increase, you know, period from 1820s, 1830s, 1840s is a violent and unstable one. And, you know, if you like, I think those tensions kind of sort of end up, you know, culminating in this kind of mutiny, in which it's not surprising that it's the people, the Indians who are the closest to the British state, soldiers, in other words, who've had the most exposure to British power and who the British rely on the most, who are the ones who rebel. You know, and it's, you know, the rebellion in, you know, a series of barracks in North India, against, the quite harsh way in which the British are trying to govern their troops, and all sorts of complaints and all sorts of concerns. But fundamentally the rebellion is about, Indian soldiers thinking that their way of life is very fundamentally going to be altered and undermined by British power. The soldiers who rebel think the British are trying to do lots of things that they're not actually trying to do. Like, you know, yes, there was an attempt to convert them to Christianity, but there was very little conversion by force. You know, there's no kind of wholesale effort to undermine Indian civilization in the way in which the soldiers think. But there are a number of, you know, flashpoints, if you like, and things that are kind of moments when, you know, kind of it looks like actually kind of the British. You know, kind of trying to transform things, and if you like, if they had the power, would have tried to transform things more fundamentally. That lead to Indian soldiers thinking that their only option to kind of maintain their way of life and to maintain any kind of sense of themselves as, you know, as Hindus and Muslims, for example, is to rebel. And so you have this kind of interaction, and that leads then to you know, kind of the countryside, rebels across the countryside, you know, peasants across the countryside rebelling. And you know, the whole of North India is a war zone, and you know, kind of out of British rule, and all sorts of, you know, and every kind of ruler, really, every local ruler has a moment of choice, and they have a moment of choice about whether they, well, three ways really, which is whether they join the British, whether they in a very emphatic way, whether they rebel or whether they just don't do anything for a while, and lots of them don't do anything and you know, see which way the wind's blowing, et cetera, et cetera. But there are a decent number who, you know, kind of who join the rebels, and, you know, the momentum of the rebellion grows and grows and grows. So until it, you know, really takes the introduction of troops from Britain and, you know, soldiers from Britain and other parts of the empire to reconquer, and it is very much reconquer, very violently reconquer, North India, and I think that's a really key moment that transforms the nature of British rule, because North India has had the emphatic assertion of British military force upon every part of it in 1857, 1858. You know, this is, you know, the violence of the rebels is devastating, and the violence of the British in response is devastating. And there's a kind of a British celebration of violence. There's no question about that. Some of the very early photographs that, you know, in which the photographers sort of arrange skulls outside of the blown up buildings to show the scale of force that's there. So this is a kind of weird moment in which kind of, the British are sort of celebrating how violent they can be, and that really does transform things quite fundamentally. And it makes I think it creates kind of unease on the part of, there's this kind of huge assertion of violence in a way that is unprecedented and very, very emotional and very kind of moralistic and all these things on the part of the British. But it also creates on the part of the British state a moment of unease and a moment of concern that, you know, that violence can just spill over, or had spilled over, and can just, you know, lead to Britain actually losing control of India. And there's a recognition of that, a recognition that, this overwhelming violence is needed to defeat the British. But it's also, it will create, it will undermine British power, you know, kind of, because it would simply create a response. And so there is a very sort of clear moment when the British say, we're going to stop now. We're going to stop fighting. There's a declaration, Queen Victoria's declaration, which basically says, that's it. You know, we've now brought India to heel, effectively, and kind of the violence is not going to continue, and Indian rulers who wish can submit themselves to the British. And that kind of moment, I think, makes the company quite hard to. It's impossible for the company to survive, because this is a moment of. It's a moment in which British power has been asserted so directly, I think, and there's a sense in which the only way in which that power can stop is if it's regulated, if it's limited very directly by the British state. And so the company actually as a sort of intermediary just evaporates, and so it's very hard to have it survive, I think, and so it ends up being abolished, and you know, all the people who've been arguing for its abolition for the previous 20 years or so are just, you know, they win the argument, and so it's Parliament that directly takes over the government of India. In practice, there isn't that much of a, in terms of the formal structure of British rule, I think there's a real difference in the attitude and in the mood of British power, as I said, because the British have asserted overwhelming force over the whole of North India. But in terms of the structure, there isn't much of a difference, other than now the line of accountability goes through a kind of Secretary of State and goes to Parliament and goes through Queen Victoria, you know, directly. But and the structure of government in terms of, you know, local government officials and so forth doesn't change that much.
Mm-hmm. And I guess we'd be going beyond the bounds of this podcast a bit to go into the Raj, but perhaps given your expertise, we could talk just a little bit about that regime. Is that the right word?
Yeah, I think I didn't, you know, until I wrote my last book, India Conquered, I didn't think that 1857 was as important as it was. But I think actually it is important as a moment in which British power is very directly and symbolically asserted. And it is, you know, called, you know, the Raj. You know, there is this account of that's not an official title, but, you know, kind of people start to use that kind of royal language to talk about British power. You know, Queen Victoria is the Empress of India. You know, in fact, she'd been described a little bit like that beforehand. But, you know, so there is this, the new thing that happens is the importance of symbolism and the importance of formal structures of symbolic power, you know, kind of allowing, buttressing British power, I think. You know, kind of, it remains a force that is very much about kind of the ability to deploy violence if necessary, but the state's assertion of power in this kind of, in some kind of symbolic means, I think becomes more and more important. And so, you know, pageantry becomes more important, for example. There are infrastructure projects and so forth that are about quite visible demonstrations of British power, including the railways and so forth, are escalate, for example, you know, increase in number and so on. So, and I think there's a funny way in which, so the British power becomes, you know, more direct and is asserted in this kind of more sort of explicit way, with the Raj. It kind of creates the potential idea of some kind of accountability that didn't exist before. And the Indians can say, well, hold on a minute, the Queen is now the ruler in a very direct way, so I have someone I can appeal to. There is a structure that allows me to kind of have some kind of conversation with my rulers and so forth. And in reality, that doesn't happen. There's not very much of that happening until much later on. But it creates some kind of notion, I think, that this is a different kind of regime, potentially, that could be more accountable, that Indians could be involved in. I think also there's a sense in which lots of Indians who have very negative views of the British, and I'm talking about middle-class Indians, elite Indians, people who work in government and so forth, just realise that actually there's not much point in being very explicitly critical, because there's the example of the mutiny, there's the example of the devastating violence of 1857, so really, if criticism needs to find a different register, it needs to find a different style. Of course, there's rebellion afterwards, of course, but it tends to be much more distant from formal political power. It tends to be, you know, peasant rebellions. It tends to be, you know, kind of people who are on the fringes of society more, who are kind of, you know, rebelling and who are kind of insurgents, because, you know, anyone who belongs to Indian ruling families just simply knows, well, this is what, you know, there's no possibility of overturning British rule through kind of war. There's no real point in trying to return to some kind of pre 1857 style of government, you know, kind of which lots of people have wanted before. You can't hanker after the Mughal Empire, because the Mughal Empire has now been, you know, utterly defeated, you know, kind of in 1857. So I think there's a really important shift in kind of political political thinking, you know, kind of, you know, both to some degree by the British, but more so, I think, by Indians.
So if we go into another listener question then, Andrew Milliken on Facebook asks, what happened to the East India Company's assets when it was wound up?
They became the British state's assets, and then in India they became the British, the government of India, and in Britain pretty much the same.
One interesting one, which again, you might be loath to make these kind of correlations, but on Facebook, Ado Mohammed asks, compared to today's tech multinationals like Amazon, Google, etc., how powerful, influential was the EIC on people's day-to-day lives? Can we make any answer to that?
So compared to... So I think it's really important when we think about the company not to think about a company. The East India Company isn't a company in the way in which we think about it now. To compare it doesn't make any sense. It's company really means kind of organization. It doesn't mean a company in the way we mean today, I don't think. So, of course, the East India Company, like companies today, was interested in making money for the early years of its history, certainly. But the reason why it was a company was because the ordinary structures of trade didn't apply. And, of course, currently, tech multinationals, very much that is the ordinary structure in which kind of trade occurs. So I think that kind of there's a really nice kind of easy, which lots of extremely good historians and writers kind of, you know, do, nice analogy between sort of, you know, corporate power then and corporate power now. And, you know, I'm not hugely averse to that kind of comparison, but I don't think it's hugely helpful. I think that kind of as a way of entering into the history of the East India Company, it's better to think about actually the history of a state and the history of kind of governmental power. I think though, let's compare a state now with a state with the East India Company. And in a way you can compare Amazon and Google with a state to some degree, you know, kind of, and you know, their forms of of intervention in people's lives are not so different, maybe, you know, kind of how they do, they monitor, they track, etc. And I think what's important is just that that you know, any state, and particularly the East India Company in kind of the 18th century, had an inordinately weaker influence on people's lives compared to kind of institutions around now. Because they just simply don't have the kind of institutional means, they don't have the technological means to do the kind of things that states do now. And I think there really is a kind of revolution in both corporate and state power that occurs in the 20th century that is all about kind of bureaucracy. It's all about, you know, kind of surveillance of various kinds. It's about, you know, forms of technology that kind of that are, I'm not talking about IT, I'm talking about electricity, you know, I'm talking about railways, I'm talking about that kind of thing, which just simply allow states and companies to do a lot more than they could do, you know, kind of, you know, sort of 200, 300 years ago. So, you know, this is a world in which it took, you know, it took 9 months to reach India. You know, so how much power is anyone in London really having over a society when, if you want to send an order, yeah, fine, maybe you could rush it there in 4 months. You know, so we need to think about power in a completely different way. So things are much more dispersed, things are much more localized. You know, kind of that isn't to say that the man on the spot, if you like, the administrator kind of in India, the British administrator in India doesn't have influence. Of course, they have lots of influence. And I think the most important difference is, of course, that that power is about violence. Power is about force. It's not about surveillance. It's not about monitoring. Not that kind of thing. It's about this kind of incredibly destructive power of violence. But, you know, violence is devastating, but it only lasts a certain amount of time. It doesn't. You know, it's not sustained in the same way that maybe, you know, Amazon and Google influence these things. So we need to kind of think about just a dramatically different world when we're comparing the kind of power that exists then and now.
If I can ask perhaps a broad one, maybe to wrap us up, and I hope this isn't too reductive, but if we look at East India Company in the early 17th century, you know, making its first forays, and then looking at the peak mid-19th century, how did it change India in most broad terms in that period?
I mean, the most important thing is that by the mid-19th century, there aren't the kind of states and forms of government and forms of political power that existed in India, you know, kind of in 1700 or whatever, or 1600. And that, you know, India was a land of lots of fairly small forms of government. You know, we have this idea of the Mughal Empire, but in fact, there were sort of thousands of chieftaincies, of mini petty states, you know, kind of local rulers of various kinds, rajas, etc. And that's the kind of, so India has a really complicated patchwork of political patchwork in which kind of power is about sort of built, you know, political power is about building up from the bottom, if you like, is about building alliances of, you know, kind of lots of small landlords, small chieftains on your side, and then if you have enough, then you can rule a certain area, and so forth, and so forth, and so forth. And that's the Mughal Emperor really is a ruler of rulers. I mean, the Mughal Emperor, one of their titles, Shah and Shah, which is, you know, kind of king of kings. But in fact, they're king of kings of kings of kings of kings. You know, because there are so many levels of power there, and so that kind of really complicated, dense structure of political power that meant that actually things were quite mobile and were quite fluid, and there's always somebody who you can negotiate with. There's always somebody you can flee to often if you do something that is bad. That kind of world has gone, and you have things are much flatter, you know. And so it's and of course there are in many places, you know, intermediaries of various kinds. There are rulers who are you know, there are landlords and so forth. But the British kind of maintains, you know, wants to maintain them in check to a degree. They, you know, limit the amount that they can bear arms. They, you know, kind of try and restrict their power. And in some places, it's East India Company officials who are not quite collecting rent, but almost even collecting rent from peasants. So, you know, kind of so the political landscape of India is just radically different. It's, you know, completely different. And I think that kind of structure of power, you know, the structure of power that existed in the 17th century or whenever, you know, under the Mughal Empire, it, you know, had many limits. You know, kind of it meant that, you know, it's hard to imagine, for example, large factory enterprises. It's hard to imagine kind of huge industrialization occurring because things have broken up into smaller kind of units and so forth. But it did maintain a kind of certain amount of prosperity. You know, trade is protected by these this kind of sort of dense network of connections and so forth that exist in India. You know, when there's a famine, there are people who can support you. There are people who have grain that's stored who need you to work on their land, and so they're going to try and make sure that you don't die out. That's that kind of protection disappears. And that's why, you know, mid-19th century India, the famines are much more devastating, you know, than they were beforehand. So, and, you know, so power has just become much more simpler and, you know, and much barer, I think. And there's fewer places where, you know, kind of Indian, you know, Indians can, few people who can support kind of sort of Indian livelihoods and so forth.
That was John Wilson. If you enjoyed today's podcast, then please do drop us a line with ideas of topics and historians you'd like us to include in the series. You can do that on our social media channels at History Extra. Thanks for listening. This episode was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. Tune in tomorrow when Catherine Bailey will be speaking about her Second World War book, Phase War.